Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Silence and Word, Path of Evangelization. We look at Pope Benedict's reflection for World Day of Communications, May 20th. And what is conscience today and are we free to use it? Canadian bishops express concern for growing threats to freedom of religion. Silence and Word, Path of Evangelization. That's the seemingly contradictory theme of the Church's 46th World Day for Communications, celebrated each year on the Sunday before Pentecost, this year on May 20th. The Pope traditionally releases his message for the occasion on January 24th, the feast day of St. Francis de Sales, the patron saint of writers. In his message, Pope Benedict refers to silence and word as two aspects of communication that need to be kept in balance if authentic dialogue and deep closeness between people are to be achieved. Linda Bordoni has more.
Silence and word, the Pope says, complement each other, giving communication value and meaning. In silence, he says, we are better able to listen to and understand ourselves. By remaining silent, we allow the other person to speak, to express him or herself. We avoid being tied simply to our own words and ideas. In this way, space is created for mutual listening, and deeper human relationships become possible. And the Pope highlights, it is often in silence that we observe the most authentic communication, taking place between people who are in love, with gestures, facial expressions and body language. In a time when messages and information are plentiful, he continues, silence becomes essential if we are to distinguish what is important from what is insignificant or secondary. And the Pope reflects on the process of communication, which nowadays is largely fueled by questions in search of answers. He mentions the role of search engines, social networks, and the internet, and points out that people today are frequently bombarded with answers to questions they have never asked and to needs of which they were unaware. If we are to recognize and focus upon the truly important questions, Benedict says, then silence is a precious commodity that enables us to exercise proper discernment in the face of the surcharge of stimuli and data that we receive. And he says that amid the complexity and diversity of the world of communications, many find themselves confronted with the ultimate questions of human existence. Who am I? What can I know? What ought I to do? What may I hope? It's important, the Pope says, to affirm those who ask those questions and to open up the possibility of a profound dialogue by means of words and interchange, but also through the call to silent reflection, something that is often more eloquent than a hasty answer and permits seekers to reach into the depths of their being and open themselves to the path towards knowledge that God has inscribed in human hearts. Men and women, he says, cannot rest content with the superficial and unquestioning exchange of sceptical opinions and experiences of life. We are all in search of truth, and we share this profound yearning today more than ever. So, the Pope points out, attention should be paid to the various types of websites, applications and social networks, as well as making space for silence and occasions for prayer, meditation or sharing of the Word of God. And pointing out that the God of biblical revelation speaks also without words, we in turn discover in silence the possibility of speaking with God and about God. In speaking of God's grandeur, he says, our language will always prove inadequate and must make space for silent contemplation, which immerses us in the source of that love, directing us towards our neighbours so that we may feel their suffering and offer them the light of Christ, his message of life and his saving gift. And speaking of the fundamental question of the meaning of human existence, the Pope says it finds in the mystery of Christ an answer capable of bringing peace to the restless human heart. The Church's mission springs from this mystery, he says, and it is this mystery which impels Christians to become heralds of hope and salvation, witnesses of that love which promotes human dignity and builds justice and peace. In conclusion, Pope Benedict said, "Learning to communicate is learning to listen and contemplate as well as speak." This, he says, is especially important for those engaged in the task of evangelization. I'm Linda Bordoni.
When they announced the theme, the Pontifical Council for Social Communications said the Holy Father clearly desired to associate it with the October Synod of Bishops, whose own theme is the new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. Well, Jean-Pierre Ruiz is a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York and an expert in new media. I asked him how silence can be a part of communicating the faith in the digital age.
I think that to choose the theme of silence as the theme for the World Communications Day is strangely eloquent, to tell you the truth, because we live in a world where words, in a certain sense, have become a cheapened commodity, and where people say, very often, much less than they actually mean. I think that by choosing silence and word, path of evangelization, as the theme for 2012 Communications Day, the Pope has told us something about the richer qualities of communication. And in fact, the Church has been about the business of communicating not only by words for a very long time, in fact, from the beginning. I say this because the Church's liturgy, for example, is not just reading, is not just text, is not merely what we say. It's also the attitude of our bodies. It's also sound without words in terms of instrumental liturgical music. It involves the use of all of our senses in terms of the sense of smell, in terms of incense, and the flowers that are used to decorate the sanctuary for the Eucharistic liturgy and for other celebrations. So if we were to reduce communication to words, I think we would be much impoverished.
Well, how does this relate then to the new media? There you have images, you have audio, you have words. How do you see silence operating in that field?
Let me go back to St. Augustine, which might sound like a strange place to start to talk about the new media, but St. Augustine was a student of St. Ambrose. And because in antiquity, students did whatever they could to imitate their teachers, particularly when their teachers were revered, there's a story that is told of Augustine coming upon his teacher Ambrose and being quite surprised by the fact that when Ambrose was reading, he was reading silently. Well, what does this mean? It means that in antiquity, the words that were written on a page of a codex or the page of a scroll, the words were shorthand for oral communication, so that when people read in antiquity, they read to themselves and to each other out loud. Libraries in the ancient world were not places where librarians went around shushing people. The noisier the library was, the more clear an indication was that the library was being appropriately used. Private reading in silence is really only an artifact of much later history. Well, what does this imply for the new media? Well, for one thing, as the internet grew of age, it grew from being principally a text-based means of communication, where people typed things to each other across fairly limited networks, and the people who engaged in this kind of typing had to be people with a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of know-how in terms of using what were the awkward, kludgy, cumbersome technologies of that moment in what is at this point the digital past, to a situation now where by Skype I can talk to and I can see someone either here in Rome or in Indonesia in real time. So the medium has made communication more transparent. And in a certain sense, that has always been the intention of communications media, that is, to facilitate contact between people, to make it possible for people to encounter each other in meaningful ways. It's never been the role of the medium, whether print or otherwise, to stand in the way of quality communication. And the new media have done quite a lot to make communication more accessible, to make communication much more available to a broader population.
It seems to me you hit a key word there, quality. We don't always have quality on the internet, in the new media. We have people expressing opinions as facts. Facts often get distorted, so it's a question of knowing where to go to get the real facts.
There's a wonderful cartoon that appeared in the New Yorker magazine some time ago, and that cartoon depicts a dog sitting at a keyboard in front of a computer, and the caption is, "On the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog." And it's a wonderful way of capturing the way in which, to a certain extent, while the new media reveal quite a lot about the world, the new media can also conceal quite a lot about the interests of the author of a particular website, the interests or the background or the expertise of someone who is presenting information to the world. Now, we like to imagine that in the past, in the old media world, there were ways of vetting, there were ways of quality control that made it possible to identify someone who was an authorized spokesman for this or that viewpoint more effectively. Well, to a certain extent that worked, but to a certain extent that became a product of the ways in which people controlled publication in terms of the expenses, the significant expenses that are associated with publication. Because to print a book, to print a newspaper, requires an enormous infrastructure, a very intricate organization of experts in the manipulation of certain technologies, and requires selling these products to whoever happens to be willing to buy them. The internet has taken the intermediary out of that to a certain extent, which means that people can self-publish, can make information available in this way or in that way without having to invest in or without having to capture the interest of others who are willing to invest in the product that they are marketing. Now, I think net-net that has made information much more available, but at the same time it's made it that much more urgent for us to develop ways in which we can discern what constitutes quality information on the internet. So you know whether you're talking to a person or you're talking to a dog who's pretending to be a person.
We've seen some aspects of the new media in Twitter and Facebook, other media platforms such as those, being used to generate revolutions.
I think that freedom of speech is a very, very important human right and a very, very important human responsibility, because from my understanding on the basis of Catholic social teaching, I understand that rights have their correlatives in responsibilities. I also don't think it's the role of government to limit the communication by their populations, because limitation almost inevitably implies repression. And repression is the enemy of democracy, and repression is the enemy ultimately of human dignity. Now, while it can take time for things to sort themselves out, and while there are people who would use the new media for ends that violate basic human dignity, I don't think that it is appropriate for government to assume the role of monitor in that respect. What is important on the part of faith communities, on the part of the church, on the part of people who are interested in and committed to the value of human dignity, to the principle of solidarity and to the principle of the common good, is a matter of educating people in terms of their lives as consumers of media, that is, of recipients of information, educating people to be discerning in the information that they receive from the internet and from newspapers and from television and from even such an ancient medium as radio. To train them.
I take offense at that, because there are many who would say that there is a future still for radio.
Oh, and I'm quite committed to the future of radio in that, for example, the new media have actually made it possible for radio to be heard and to be used in all sorts of new ways that were never envisioned in the days of Marconi. So it is a medium that has persisted and that has stood the test of time in terms of its adaptability to new technologies, because in the end there's nothing more powerful than the sound of the human voice. There's nothing more powerful than that. And to put a lid on that, to put a limit on the capacity for human beings to express what they really mean and to come into contact with each other by hearing the sound of each other's voices, there's nothing that replaces that. At the same time, as important as it is to educate people with respect to how they receive media, it is important to educate people with respect to their responsibility as communicators, that nothing we say is ever neutral. There's nothing that we say that doesn't need to be thought through in terms of the potential consequences, in terms of the behaviors that can be inspired by the sorts of things that we say. The sorts of things that we can say can lead us, on the one hand, to empathize with, to be in solidarity with someone halfway across the world whom we've never met, but to whom we are bound by our same human condition. And as Christians, by virtue of the fact that we recognize each other as brothers and sisters made by the same God. On the other hand, we know how words can inspire violence, how words can turn people against each other, how the violence of words can lead to bloodshed. And we need to educate people to that reality as well.
Do you think the Catholic Church is effective enough in this area of helping people to discern the negative aspects within the new media and also to educate them about how to receive it?
I think that the Pontifical Council for Social Communications and other entities within the Church globally and the Church in various local settings in many cases have taken the lead in educating people to that. I think that we have a lot yet to learn from the new media, and things move so quickly that this is a growth area for the Church and for the Church's ministries, because it does represent such important new opportunities for evangelization, for catechesis, for getting the word out about what's been called the Church's best-kept secret, which is its social teaching. The popes have made increasing use of electronic media in getting the word out. The late Pope John Paul II, for example, was as much pastor as he was media star, very conscious of the way in which his image and the sorts of things that he said in media moments made a difference in the way in which the Church was perceived and received, not just superficially, but very deeply. And Pope Benedict has followed up on this in the way in which he has encouraged the Pontifical Council for Social Communication and other entities in the Roman Curia and other offices within the Church to use the new media responsibly. The reconfiguration of the Vatican website, for example, is an exciting development, and I'm sure is an area that is under considerable growth and development and redevelopment and thinking and rethinking as it becomes more and more a cutting-edge thing. It's my understanding that the Holy See has a YouTube channel, which is, in terms of the new media, a very cutting-edge, not only technology, but outreach to generations that might have been less comfortable with old media venues for receiving words from the Church, who now have not only access to, but the availability of the real thing on the small screen.
And a warm thanks there to Father Jean-Pierre Ruiz, a biblical scholar and theology professor at St. John's University in New York. Canada's Catholic bishops are expressing concern about what they call an aggressive relativism that seeks to relegate religion to the private sphere in their country. In a pastoral letter issued by the CCCB, the Canadian Catholic Bishops' Conference, they point to emerging threats to freedom of conscience and freedom of religious expression. Well, my colleague Christopher Wells spoke to the Bishops' Conference president, Archbishop Richard Smith of Edmonton, about the bishops' concerns. Let's listen.
We've written a pastoral letter on the issues of freedom of conscience and of religion. We have issued it to the people of Canada, not to any government in particular, but we've issued it first place, of course, to our own people, but at the same time to all people. And what has occasioned it is what has been observed not only by us, but by many, of course, over the years, of the various threats to, or indeed sometimes overt attacks upon, both of these fundamental human freedoms. So, for example, internationally, we've seen the horrific attacks in Egypt, the massacre of Coptic Christians, or the terrorist attacks on Christian churches in Nigeria. There's the issue of the persecution of the Catholic Church in China, and all of these things. But we also notice in our own country far more subtle challenges to freedom of conscience, freedom of religion. Certainly, thanks be to God, not the violence here, but challenges nevertheless, such as, for example, when a state marriage commissioner wants to object on the basis of conscience to presiding at same-sex wedding, often that person is forced to resign, or sometimes colleges of physicians will pressure their members who morally object under their freedom of conscience to, say, performing an abortion. They'll feel pressured to refer their patients to others who will, or pharmacists that feel pressured to give out medications that might have, for example, abortifacient effects. These are all attacks on freedom of conscience, and if these are motivated as well by religious conviction, they're attacks on religion. We see freedom of religion challenged when Catholic schools, for example, may be pressured by the state to introduce particular practices in response to one of a number of given issues that might be or would be counter to the teaching of the Church. I mean, the Church is free, and Catholic schools must be free within their own ambits to do what they do in accordance with the Church teaching. And when the state presumes to interfere with that, that's a violation of religion. The essential point, a couple of essential points to keep in mind, is that these are inherent human rights. They are not granted by the state, therefore they cannot be taken away by the state, but must instead be honored and protected by the state. Where this does not happen, we feel impelled to speak. Our own Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, in fact, upholds these as fundamental human rights. Indeed, among the list of fundamental human rights listed in our Charter, first are freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. However, that doesn't seem to be particularly effective of late, actually bringing about effective protection. So we want to raise the question. We want to say to folks, these are fundamental principles. They must be protected. We need to understand conscience correctly. We need to form it. We need to work towards having healthy church-state relations based not on a radical secularity, but on what we could call a legitimate one, wherein the political sphere, the religious sphere, are recognized as having autonomous spheres of action. One does not run the other, but they do intersect in that our common life together and our political life can never be separated from morality or ethics. That's where society does need the religious voice. The effective functioning of a democracy is absolutely dependent upon protection of fundamental human freedoms. That includes freedom of conscience and freedom of religious expression.
And Archbishop Smith, Canada certainly has a reputation for being very tolerant and very open and very diverse. Can you give us a little bit of the context? You know, how does your call as the Canadian bishops fit into Canada's history and general national consciousness of diversity and openness to different ideas and different opinions?
I have to say the history of church-state relations in the country generally is pretty good. And the response of our Canadian society to the religious voice varies depending upon the issue. So, for example, if as a legitimate expression of religious freedom, we work among the poor, we house the homeless, we set up systems of health care, our Catholic hospitals, where we set up systems of education and where we are trying to help the marginalized. That's when society looks to the church and praises it and recognizes in an immediate way the importance of having the religious voice for the common good. On the other hand, though, when the church, again in fidelity to its mission, will challenge the status quo by speaking, for example, in defense of the right to life from fertilization to natural death, speaking in defense of traditional marriage and challenging prevailing opinions that are counter to the gospel, then we find that the reaction is the opposite. And that's where we start to hear comments like, you know, freedom of religion is really just freedom of worship. So keep your comments to yourself, confined to the home, confined to the church. It ought not to have any bearing upon the formulation of public policy. It ought not to enter into, you know, commonly called the public square. But it's there precisely that the bishops want to remind the country that the full gamut of the church's insight and of the insight of all people of faith needs to be brought to bear upon common society. We're not saying, obviously, that we want to walk through the halls of our parliament quoting the creed or waving the book of canon law. But we have a 2,000-year tradition of prayerful reflection upon the human condition that has given rise to wonderfully beautiful, hope-filled insights that for the sake of the good of our brothers and sisters with whom we live in fundamental human solidarity, we want to contribute. So insights into the dignity of the human person, recalling to society that the human being, in virtue of the way in which we have been created, is open to the transcendent, has an eternal destiny. Our insights into the nature of family and how that needs to get protected, our insights with respect to social justice, our insights with respect to the principles that need to be brought to bear on the healthy or the functioning of a healthy economy for the good of all. These are all issues that the challenge prevailing methods of thought, they're insights that come from our faith tradition, from our religious beliefs, and really do and must intersect with the common discernment of society for the sake of the common good. And if these insights forged within a religious sphere are cast to the side and silenced, then our entire society is greatly impoverished as a result.
What are you hoping people will take away from this? How do you expect or hope that people, not just Catholics, but Canadians generally, and what do you hope that they will do with this message that you've given as the Canadian Bishops' Conference?
Well, in terms of Catholics, first of all, I would want them, I would hope, that they will take some time and make sure that they understand what conscience is. And then I think it's important for our Catholics to understand that these are fundamental human rights, that they ought not to be afraid to speak up in their defense, and where the right to conscientious objection is being threatened, also to speak up. For society generally, I would hope that we take the time and really ponder what we mean by conscience. One of the difficulties today, it seems to me, is that we no longer understand what conscience is. It seems to be operating in many people's minds and lives at that rather hazy level of subjective feeling. But conscience is a capacity within the human person whereby we freely discern what is morally obligatory. Conscience is not licensed to do whatever I want. And as a human capacity, much the same as we have the capacity to speak or to think, yet these capacities need to be developed and trained and formed, so too does conscience need to be formed. So let's understand what conscience is, first of all, and let's make the effort to form it properly so that by exercising our right and protecting our right, we live not only fully as human beings, but also in a way that does contribute to the well-being of our brothers and sisters, for the sake of the common good.
And a warm thanks there to Archbishop Richard Smith of Edmonton and President of the Canadian Catholic Bishops' Conference. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.